Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films podcast. I am Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
And we're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 2017's 50 Years Ago Today, Sgt. Pepper and Beyond, a documentary made to celebrate the 50th anniversary of what is often called the greatest album of all time. So does the film do justice to the album? Does it explain that it's a concept album that isn't really a concept album, but really still is a concept album? And does any of this matter when, as is assumed, we'll just spend the time tapping our feet to all the great songs that make up the album, as they are no doubt featured heavily throughout the film? Ed, do you want to cover off that last point?
Right, we've got into that straight away. fair enough, because it is really the crux of the whole thing, and the crux of this entire podcast episode, as we're about to talk about in punishing detail. So I reviewed this film back in 2017 when it came out. I think I was slightly too harsh on it, which I think we'll come to later, but
I will interject and say I read your review after watching the film. I don't think you were harsh on it at all. I think it exactly chimes with how I feel about the film. But by all means, retroactively correct yourself.
Yeah, it's a public mea culpa. I think I was a little bit too harsh on it, but the main criticisms I still hold. And of course, the chief one is this is a documentary about Sgt. Pepper as an album, which does not have the rights to use any of the actual music, any Beatles music at all. At least I'm going to assume they didn't have the rights. If not, it was a very odd artistic choice.
It definitely was, yeah. I think the problem then extends to a greater issue that I have with the documentary, which is that largely the film doesn't really know what story it's trying to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because we know that it's a documentary that was released to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the album. By not having the music to help it do that, the film is largely made up of storytelling, anecdotes, and context setting
mm-hmm.
around that film's release.
Yeah.
But the result is then that you're just concentrating on a relatively arbitrary period of time in the Beatles' career.
Yeah.
And then it loses its sense of purpose, I think. Yeah. I think the film doesn't really know, if it's not going to be about Sgt. Pepper's, it doesn't really know what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, so it does, so kind of the period we're covering is sort of mid to late 66 when they stop touring and they go into the studio. Then when they record Sgt. Pepper, there are lots of bits from 1967, not Magical Mystery Tour or Hello, Goodbye or anything like that. That's not really in there. Then it's Maharishi, Rishikesh, and that's kind of it.
Epstein's death, I'd say, as well. Yeah, there's a lot of time on that.
Of course,
obviously. And I think that, I mean, straight off the bat, by the way, the first sort of text on screen says August 1966, the start of an incredible year, which, first of all, I'll be honest, I had to reread a couple of times to understand, because it's like, well, it's August. It's not the start of an incredible year. It's, you're halfway through it.
Yeah, we're still and using then I was, the obviously, Gregorian you're talking calendar, about, right?
Yeah, and I'm guessing that the film is suggesting that August to August.
Yeah, I suppose.
But then what the film immediately does then is talk about their time touring 2 months before.
Yes.
Because then you have footage of them, you know, on tour, and the text comes up on screen, July 1966. So already it's like, okay, so you've already gone back 2 months. So you set out, this is the start of the of an amazing year, but you've gone back 2 months in time in order to be able to set up that context. And the first big issue that the documentary deals with is the Beatles are bigger than Jesus quote.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, first of all, I think that immediately this doesn't feel like it is leading to, or it doesn't feel like this is part of the Sgt. Pepper narrative, but I'm probably being a bit too harsh there, because I think what the film is trying to do is set the context of why the Beatles stopped touring.
Yeah.
And then that obviously led to them having more studio time and being able to focus on recording, which I understand. But it spends a lot of time on this particular quote, and it feels like we're already into just talking about major Beatles talking points, rather than focusing on a particular strand.
Yeah, maybe, and also perhaps what it's doing is that the things it discusses are the things for which it has enough footage to discuss.
Yeah, that's fair.
That may be it. I mean, you know, the bigger than Jesus stuff, you know, there's John doing his public apology at the press conference, and there's the KKK guy, you know, and people jumping up and down on records in the street. So maybe that's it. But I think, in fairness to it, it is taking, it is setting the scene. It is odd that it says, you know, August and then goes back 2 months, but it is setting the scene for why they stopped touring. And then, you know, why they're making Sgt. Pepper. So I think that's reasonable, but it does highlight a really odd scattergun approach to what it's showing you, and also the order in which it's showing you it, which is kind of all over the place.
That is very much all over the place. I think going back to the Jesus Christ thing, I think that first of all, it's really strange to have the talking heads on this documentary talk about that moment. Obviously, no doubt, a hugely significant moment in the Beatles' career, and talk about it in a way that they seem to be arguing the actual quote itself,
the merits of it.
Merits of the quote. Were the Beatles actually bigger than Jesus?
Right, exactly.
Which is weird. Like, not talk about the how the quote came to be, not talk about the context of the interview that was given at the time, and necessarily they're not even really necessarily talking about the impact of that whole thing in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
They are literally arguing, were the Beatles bigger than Jesus?
Right, and a couple of the talking heads say, yes, they were.
doubt.
Yeah, it was Andy Peebles and Simon Napier-Bell both very much come down on the side of yes, the Beatles were bigger than Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Which is untrue. Of course, they weren't. They still aren't. Jesus is still doing decent numbers.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's all going strong.
Yeah. And fair play to him, you know.
Absolutely. Although, to be fair to him, we're not currently running a podcast about him. So really, arguably, who's bigger?
True. Yeah, Jesus Films podcast. What could we get for that? Last Temptation of Christ?
What can we get? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Films starring about or inspired by Jesus Christ.
Arguably, all of them. If you're going to go down the inspired
by route, you know. That's a lot of ground to cover. I'm glad we chose the Beatles. But the weird thing about how that whole issue gets discussed then is this was a point that was solved at the time.
Yeah.
Like John Lennon was forced to make an apology, we know, about contextualizing his comments, all of which ring true in terms of, you know, we were talking about the church in terms of, you know, popularity with the youth at the time. So there's no need to discuss this point, right?
Mm.
I just feel like it's covering old ground. And I feel like there's probably a bit of a problem I have with how this documentary doesn't know how much it wants its interviewees to give genuine insight, and how much it wants it to just retread the same old stories and the same old ground in order to tell us the story that most of us Beatles fans are already familiar with.
Perhaps it wants its talking heads to actually just walk us through the narrative. Some of the talking heads are sort of more insightful than others. But in a structural sense, maybe that's what they're there to do, which is weird considering that actually its narrative is kind of all over the place, as we said, and it's not really taking, it doesn't have to take you through it in a sort of linear chronological fashion, but it needs to pick an approach.
Yeah.
It doesn't really do that.
I think, by the way, that really gets pulled into focus when I think it's Simon Napier-Bell.
Yeah.
Who at one point he's telling a story and he actually says, and it includes it in the film, where he literally says, do you want me to tell the story? Okay, yeah. Fine. And he just does it, right? And it's like, that's quite clearly then there's a call that's been made there by whoever's behind the camera to be like, no, I want you to tell the story that clearly you know and I know has been told 100 times before.
Yeah. Although, actually, that is not a story that I'd heard before.
Oh, and to be fair, also not one I had either, but this is the answer phone one, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is Simon Napier-Bell, is one of the more interesting talking heads in it. So he was someone I was aware of who had been a sort of music manager in the 70s and 80s. I knew he'd managed Wham and lots of other bands who I can't remember, but you would immediately recognise. I didn't realise he was an associate or a friend of Brian's at all. So his input was really, really interesting. And yeah, he tells a story about on the weekend that Brian died, when we know he'd sort of driven up to a friend's house in the country and then sort of decided to come home quite abruptly. And Simon Napier-Bell had gone on holiday and he had come back to lots and lots of increasingly sort of desperate voice messages from Brian on his answer phone, which is a really sad story, and it's affecting and it's new. I didn't know it before because, I didn't know of Simon Napier-Bell as an associate of his. But you're right, that is an odd way to frame it. You know, you get a lot of documentaries now where every true crime Netflix documentary now starts with main talking head comes in, sits down at the chair, sort of adjusts themselves.
Yes, that's right.
Adjusts their microphone, says, right, so are we ready then? And it's, is it like a Verite style? Thing where you see they're talking to camera, but then you also see another camera that is filming, the camera that's filming them. And showing
the B-roll as well as,
and showing you the mechanics of the thing. This documentary doesn't do that. Except for that one bit.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very strange. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a couple of things I want to pick up on that. But one thing, the last point I wanted to make about this scattergun approach that the documentary has with its subject matter is the very, very end. And I think it's worth calling that out now because I think it is so bizarre. I think I watched this film thinking that this is broadly a collection of anecdotes from August 1966, apparently, through to tail end of 1967.
Yep.
Right. And that encompasses the approach to the recording of and the subsequent release of Sergeant Pepper,
yeah,
but isn't focused just on that period. So when we talk about the title of the film being 50 years ago, Sergeant Pepper and beyond, I guess arguably the film is doing that because it's stretching the time period either side of that without really giving a huge amount of focus on the actual release itself.
Yeah.
But then I feel like it doesn't really know how to end because the Beatles' career continues, obviously, beyond this release.
Yeah.
So it reaches a point after talking through several important factors in the career where it gets to the end of the documentary and the only way it knows how to end is on a text screen, which says, and I took a picture, which says, out of nowhere, this does feel like out of nowhere, it says, 538 days after the release of Sgt. Pepper, the Beatles released a double album containing 30 brand new songs in a plain white sleeve. It went straight to number one right across the globe.
Mm.
That's odd.
Yeah.
it's odd to then... To have that detail at the end suggests that in some way, everything contained in the documentary had that as its end goal, or yes, had that as a purpose. It's like, you know, like, yeah, it's taken like the trope of like a biopic or a documentary where, you know, where it, like, it would say like, you know, she went on to win the Nobel Prize, right, or, yeah, or yeah, like he broke the land speed record four times in his life, or, you know, or Sam Beckett never made it home. You know,
right, right.
You know, there is, like, you expect the text at the end to be the point at which everything's been working towards.
Yeah.
And it's really odd that they just just decided to chuck in this sort of reference to the White Album, completely missing Magical Mystery Tour in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Just another illustration of why the film doesn't really feel like it knows what it's doing, all its purposes.
No, and I think this is perhaps the problem with a documentary about an album in the middle of a band's career. So if it was a documentary about Hamburg, or if it was a documentary about Please Please Me, then it could, as its card at the end, could say, the Beatles went on to be the biggest band in
exactly
the world.
Yeah.
Or, as I think I'm right in saying, Get Back finishes with After the Rooftop and then the bits they record in the studio afterwards. Does it? Maybe I'm wrong about this. In my mind, it's got a thing at the end that basically says this would be the last public performance the Beatles ever gave.
Yes.
And they split up.
Double check. I think the thing that you mentioned in your review of this was that arguably this makes for a decent sequel to 8 Days a Week, the touring years. The Ron Howard documentary.
Oh, I did say that. That was clever, wasn't it?
It was clever. Yeah, well done. Yeah, thank you. I mean, I don't want to give you too much credit because actually what the film does that you failed to mention was actually there's a significant overlap with the end of those touring years. But immediately you have a clear difference between the approaches of documentaries because 8 Days a Week, the touring years, sets out its story and this is what we are going to cover.
Yeah.
And actually Sgt. Pepper and Beyond is mostly in terms of time dedicated to about Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah.
But no, like it extends way beyond that. It includes so many other chapters of what we consider to be different segments of the Beatles' career within it that it doesn't really have a clear angle that the film is trying to shed light on.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, that ending is also frustratingly easy to fix as well. It's just you change that card to be Sgt. Pepper has gone on to be, and it has sold this many copies, and
Doesn't even mention that, right? Doesn't even mention how the actual numbers that are that quantify its success.
Yeah, and it sort of seems to feel like it should give a sense of closure, where actually it doesn't. You know,
like the
film about the organized crime gang that just always ends, when it's based on real people, that always ends with the prison sentences everyone received, right? It gives a sense of closure.
Yes.
Like, this is what happened to everyone. This guy went into witness protection. This guy got 25 years. This guy died in prison. You know, fine. I think it seems to think that it should tie everything up, and it doesn't need to, because it's a story people know.
Mm.
I mean, then again, you know, if it's a story everyone knows, then why do a documentary about it? There needs to be some concession to the idea that an audience is seeing this information for the first time, to be fair.
And I feel like I'm trying to make allowances for that, because I think there is an argument that the documentary covers a lot of old ground.
Yeah.
But arguably that's only old ground because we already know it. There is a justifiable reason to bring old stories together if there is a coherent through line that makes sense for those stories to hang together to tell a narrative.
And
I think the problem, this film doesn't have a clear narrative.
There
is a collection of, you know, like, you might as well, like, you know, it is basically a Beatles anecdotes greatest hits, right? of that particular period.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And going back to the original point about, obviously, the film doesn't have the rights to play the music. And I do think that that is why the film largely is unfocused, because it clearly is trying to do something that it wasn't allowed to do.
Yeah.
Therefore, should it have been made? Like, I don't, you know, there's a lot of talented people who have come together to make a film.
Yeah.
I don't want to suggest they shouldn't have bothered, right? But right. I think I guess there's a larger question around whether or not any documentary about a set selection of music can do a good enough job, or can do what it's set out to, if it can't actually illustrate the points it's trying to make with the music in question.
Yeah, very true. And I think it's not so much like, you know, should they have bothered making it, but I mean, it's more just, we should have been retooled to fit those circumstances. So what it sort of half does and half doesn't do is, you think about sort of, I don't know, VH1 classic albums or something like that, where here's this album, and they're not necessarily talking track by track, you know, from number one to the last one, but they are going through the songs and illustrating that with the music itself.
Yeah.
So there are bits in it. So there are songs it does talk about. There are songs it ignores completely. But I think if you think about the sort of, you know, less, it's stupid to say that any song on Sgt. Pepper is lesser known, but if you think about sort of like Lovely Rita or Good Morning, Good Morning,
yeah,
you know, they're not songs that absolutely everybody knows. They don't discuss those quite so much. But
there are loads of songs I don't discuss.
Right? Yeah,
I mean, they talk through, obviously, the conception of Sergeant Pepper as a concept. Obviously, they talk about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, talk about Day in the Life.
Yeah,
being for the benefit of Mr. Kite.
Yep.
But that's and Within Without You, right? So and we should talk about that as well. But but that's it. Like they don't really like if a film that is trying to coincide with an anniversary, like you know it should be in some way paying tribute to the timeliness of its release.
Mm.
It doesn't dig into the album and the songs, you know. It's very much more concerned with the Beatles' career and them as people than it is about the actual product of the album.
Yeah, and I think at the point where it knows it can't play any of the songs, probably the thing to do was new creative approach.
Yeah.
This is a film about the Beatles in 1967.
Yeah,
you know, and talk about the same grounds trodden by. So one of the talking heads is Steve Turner, who wrote the book Beatles 66, which is excellent. He gives lots and lots of good insight. Maybe the whole film should have been about that period. So he's talking about stopping touring in 66, and sort of goes on until sort of the early 67, and at least kind of sets the scene for what would come next. Because I think they should have maybe picked, rather than focus so much on the album itself, picked a specific thing to talk about. I think, you know, because there's lots and lots of interesting little things they were getting up to that year. I think sort of Magic Alex was turning up and they went off to Greece to see if they could buy an island and stuff like that. And this sort of lovely sort of communist utopia idea they were thinking about. Maybe you can't get a whole documentary out of that, but I mean,
but also, like, if a documentary is commissioned to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have the rights to the music,
make
a film about the impact of Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
Right? Like make a film about what led to Sgt. Pepper. Do the before or the after.
Yeah.
Don't do all of it and in between.
Yeah,
and not really land any of it.
Yes, no, I think that's fair. your prognosis is correct.
Excellent. Okay, concurred. shall we talk about the selection of talking heads that are included in the film?
Yeah.
Who do we have first of all?
We have got a. I feel like I'm introducing them on Celebrity Squares. we have got, first up,
Philip Norman. Tonight's head I'm going to be.
what it does have, one of its big plus points, is it has a very good array of like very reputable Beatle authors. So, yep. I mean, there will be people who have sort of differing opinions about different authors, of course. But they are all pulled from generally what you might think of as the cream of the crop in terms of people who have written significant or well thought of books. So the only really, really significant one who is missing is Mark Lewisohn. Other than that, you have Ray Connolly. There's Philip Norman, who at the time might have been a slightly controversial choice because he'd written a John Lennon biography and a book called Shout, in which he is very, very pro-Lennon, anti-McCartney in that sort of old-fashioned way that people used to think about them, of sort of Lennon being the avant-garde one and McCartney being more lightweight. There is Steve Turner, as I mentioned, who wrote the Beatles 66 book. There's Hunter Davis, who is the only official Beatles biographer, a biography of the band. Maybe that's about it.
So those are the Beatles authors / journalists.
Yeah.
You also have you've got Julia Baird, obviously, as John Lennon's sister.
Yeah.
You have Bill Harry is someone who is credited as not even his job title, but he's just credited as Merseybeat newspaper.
Right, he is Merseybeat newspaper.
Yes, yeah, that is his. Yeah. That is his role.
Yeah, so he was a he was at art college with Lennon and Sutcliffe, I think, and then he founded the Merseybeat newspaper, which sort of chronicled the Liverpool music scene at the time. It's the place where John used to have a column, and he wrote that article about where they got the name Beatles off a man on a flaming pie.
Right.
So he's in this. So, I mean, he is... It's funny because I think maybe at the time when I first saw this, I thought, well, he's a good source for the early days, but how much does he know about Sergeant Pepper? But he was in London at that time. You know, he'd sort of moved down and he was sort of working in PR in London.
Mm.
So I think, you know, and I think he was still seeing them a fair bit.
He was on the scene.
Yeah.
We also have Barbara O'Donnell, who's Brian Epstein's secretary at the time.
Yeah.
There's also Tony Bramwell, who's credited as NEMS / Apple Records.
Yeah.
Who he?
He is an old school friend of the Beatles who then works as their road manager, I think, alongside Neil Aspinall, and then worked for NEMS and Apple in sort of various capacities, I think. So he's a very good source.
And also one of the probably, I mean, to be fair, all of the interviews in the documentary provide their own unique insight that it is actually just, I think, does lend credibility to the film. There's not much, I don't think, in terms of the interview matter in the documentary that feels like it's lightweight. All of it feels like it adds something.
Yeah.
But there are some of the talking heads that feel like what they contribute is actually, I don't want to say more interesting, but maybe of more value. I think he's one of the people that when he's on screen, he's like, oh, actually, this is something that feels like it's, has more weight to it.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair. I think Steve Diggle from Buzzcocks.
I was going to get to him, yes.
Yeah. So he's one of the talking heads, and, there are a couple of things he says about the dynamic of being in a band, which is sort of interesting and insightful.
Because he's in the Buzzcocks, so he knows about being in a band.
Right, exactly.
Does his insight extend beyond that?
not particularly, but like, I don't want to be unfair to him because, I mean, the guy is basically there because he's a big and knowledgeable Beatles fan.
Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of people are big and knowledgeable Beatles fans. I felt like there's quite a lot of talking heads in it. You could have removed Steve Diggle and not really lost anything. I'm not trying to be unkind to him, but there is no great reason for him to be in the documentary.
But I will say that you don't punish people for being big and knowledgeable Beatles fans, and for them to and for them to feel like they are entitled to be included in some kind of Beatles related media outlet. We should take a long hard look at them.
Oh god, I've blown the whole thing apart. This is the final episode. We're done.
It's quite good, let's pull the plug right now.
Well, we had a good run.
No, fair enough. Okay, so I think that's, you know, it's an interesting selection of talking heads in that I think that I feel like whenever you know, in the context of Beatles documentaries, it has to be said that there are a lot of Beatles documentaries out there that are terrible.
Yes,
that are very cheaply made.
Yeah,
with with names that are far less credible than the ones you just listed there.
Definitely.
Like it'll be, you know, Paul Ross. That's the way he came to mind, but he tends to be on those things, right?
I know what you mean.
And actually, this is a really good, solid selection. I feel like a newcomer to the documentary might be hoping for Paul and Ringo.
Right. Yeah.
And that's just not the case. So being realistic, actually, this selection is actually a very, very credible selection of people to talk about this subject matter.
Yeah, I would say so. And actually, when you said that there are lots and lots of very bad Beatles documentaries out there, it reminded me of one we sidebar very briefly to talk about the worst Beatles documentary I've ever seen.
I mean, do you want to talk about that, or do you want to cover it in this entirely different episode?
No, I never want to think about it ever again.
Then proceed.
It was, you know, anyone who has the Amazon Prime video will know that there is not an awful lot of quality control in terms of what they let on there. So I think they must have deals where sort of independent filmmakers can get sort of $100 or something, you know, for having their thing on there. And so when I first had access to Prime Video, I did a Beatles search, the sort of first keyword I searched, and came across a documentary called A Beatle in Benton, Illinois.
What was it called?
A Beatle in Benton. So Benton, Illinois is the little town where George's sister lived. She'd emigrated. So George was the first Beatle ever to visit America. He went before they toured America because his sister went there. And so he went out to visit her just after the band had started, but before anyone knew who they were. So maybe in 63, 64. And so this is a whole documentary about the people who were there at the time. So they've all got anecdotes about it. And the worst one by far was that a guy said, well, there was a rock and roll band, a local rock and roll band who were playing. And we sort of went along to see them in this diner or whatever it was. And George got up on stage with them. Then they interviewed the guitarist from this rock and roll band from 1963. And he says, but the funny thing was, after the show, I was sitting there just sort of playing this little riff on the guitar. And he starts playing the riff to Ticket to Ride. And George came over to me and he said, hey, what's that you're playing? And then, lo and behold, 2 years later, and I was like, mate, that isn't... It is such an obvious lie.
Yeah.
Like, George didn't even write that riff. I think John wrote that riff anyway. But in any case, like, it's just an easily provable lie that you just let in your documentary. And I do think that one of the things about Beatles documentaries, I think there is an obligation to get the facts right. You know, this is exactly why Mark Lewisohn is writing these books.
Yeah.
That this is important. Not just cultural history, but just history in general. And it is important to get these things right so that sort of misinformation doesn't spread too much. You know?
Are there any instances here, he says knowingly, in this film in particular, where there are some statements made that feel like they need some kind of corroboration?
Funny you should say that, mate.
I thought you might find that funny.
There is, well, I mean, this is something that I mentioned in the review I wrote 5 years ago. And I will say that I'm not quite so sure of my ground as I was 5 years ago. But so Jenny Boyd, who's Patty Boyd's sister and therefore George's sister-in-law at the time, she claims credit for having come up, not invented the phrase, but read the phrase "within you, without you" in a book, and then called George, and George says, "Oh yeah, that's good." That does not chime with George's recollection of writing the song, but it doesn't directly contradict it. It's fair to say. So in his "I Me Mine" book, where he gives very very brief. attention to each song he wrote and how he wrote it.
Right.
He says that he wrote the song on the melody or the tune on a harmonium at Klaus Voormann's house in Hampstead. And then he says, I finished off the lyrics later. Right. So that doesn't directly contradict what Jenny Boyd said. It may be that, you know, later on he got that call and then he put the lyrics in. I don't know. But it's not really his account of writing the song.
I will say that... there is something to be said, and again, this doesn't directly contradict the claim that is made there by Jenny Boyd, but it's interesting that for all of the Beatles history that you have consumed as a fan over many, many years, that hasn't come up before.
Right.
Right? I'm assuming that that hasn't been suggested before in any other documentary. Or by anyone else other than Jenny Boyd. Well, I guess is the question, right?
Yeah, I mean, this. But by the way, I mean, let me be clear. I'm not saying for a second that I think she's lying.
No, it sounds like it. It sounds like it.
Let's see if we get her on an interview.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. I heard that later on she jammed the opening riff to Ticket to Ride.
Now that is true. But I'm not saying for a minute that she is lying. I think there, you can see it in the Beatles' own recollections. I mean, you know, maybe George is misremembering it.
Their
memories are not. But no one's memories from around that time are completely reliable.
And also, to be fair, like Jenny Boyd, when she's talking about that exact moment, talks a lot about how much pot they were smoking at the time. So her recollection, you know, absolutely might be more accurate than George's own. But also, arguably, everyone's recollection at that time is questionable.
And also, it was 50 years ago, right? You know, I mean, you will have forgotten a lot of things. Now, it may be she's misremembered it. As we all do, you kind of take a scenario that's in your head that didn't quite happen that way, and then in a few years' time, it's solidified into your head as something that did happen that way. It may be that it actually did happen. It actually did happen exactly as she said. This is the thing. Like, we're obviously not in a position to make that judgment. But I mean, the only point I'm making in terms of how the film is made is that it needs to interrogate things like that a bit more. I think it's Beatles history is just littered with people who claim responsibility for various little things. There's always a guy who's like, oh, I delivered John Lennon a wardrobe, and he said, oh, what kind of wood is that? And I said, oh, it's Norwegian. You know, like, it's just loads and loads of people who've just got these little stories where they just claim
perfectly a bit of responsibility. Normal conversation to have.
Yeah, exactly. Donovan being a great example, of course.
Yes, of course, yeah.
I just think it's important to get those things right. It isn't always possible to get those things right. I just don't think that the film made quite enough of an effort.
I do agree with you that when it comes to what the statements that the Talking Heads make feel like they should be backed up by some kind of archival evidence.
Yes.
And where it's not, it makes the film seem lazy.
Yes.
And actually, you know, there would be a perfectly reasonable view, I think, that the film isn't a great deal better than some of those other Beatles documentaries you mentioned that are available on Amazon Prime to watch. Other than the fact that it has a fairly credible Talking Heads selection and was released at the time of the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
I feel like those two things give it a higher profile, but otherwise it's sort of been made with probably the same attention to detail as some of the other documentaries that we've seen that we otherwise trash.
No, I think it's a bit better than that, to be fair.
You reckon?
It is certainly not on the level of it's certainly not the level of that, but you know, there is a base level of Beatles documentaries that you'll see if you search on a streaming service. It will come up and you can just tell from the image it's using. I mean, there was one that I can't remember what it was, but like that I started watching, and just immediately, because of the Talking Heads were, you know, sort of Paul Ross or whoever, you know, that kind of that kind of level. I'm sorry, Paul Ross, but it's like, but you are a byword for this.
He's,
you know,
he's not listening. He's listening. He will 100% listen to this.
Yeah, he listens to everything. but you know, it kind of reminded me of. Do you remember when the Beatles anthology came out in 1995?
And
ITV did. There was like a half-hour program that they showed just before the first episode.
I don't remember that.
Or maybe the week before the first episode. No, sorry. What it was? It was before the debut of the Free as a Bird video.
Oh, yes. No, I do know about that.
Yeah, and they had a half-hour program whose premise was, weren't the Beatles great? And it just had Talking Heads. Bruce Forsyth was one, I remember. Lulu, Noel Gallagher was one. And I'm sure there are other people as well. But
those three are enough. How can you better?
Yeah,
Bruce Forsyth, Lulu, and Noel Gallagher.
Well, it's the Holy Trinity, isn't it? Lulu was kind of there at the time, to be fair.
Let's say we'll get round to that at some point.
Right? Yeah.
But that is doing what it is set out to.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Right. That is, like, what, you know, weren't the Beatles great? Because this is on the cusp of
a recognised resurgence of an appreciation of the Beatles at that time, 95, right? I think here it's a little bit different. We're talking about a film that was made only five, or released only 5 years ago.
Yep.
I do recognise you saying that the film is of a better quality and a better standing than some of the other awful Beatles documentaries out there. I recognise you saying that. I will challenge you with one particular talking head.
Okay.
I feel like you know which one. Hunter Davies at one point talks about Brian Epstein's, I guess, he talks about his personal life at a time when the Beatles started to have less of a need for him.
Yes.
And there is a section within the documentary that discusses how Brian Epstein then, without having as much to do with the Beatles, I guess there's a suggestion there that he went a little bit off the rails or started taking more drugs and started to, I guess, retreat into himself a little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like that is a perfectly reasonable part of the narrative to present.
Yeah.
I feel like the language that Hunter Davies uses when he talks about this is objectionable.
Yes. Yeah.
The first thing he says is, Brian Epstein is a homosexual.
Yeah.
And he says that like it's an excuse for what then Hunter Davies is then about to tell in this part of the interview.
Right, he says it as if like, well, I might as well say it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like, well, I mean, like, he's a homosexual, so you know what I'm about to say next, so right?
Which is conclusions,
horrible, right?
Yes.
Horrible.
Yes, it is.
But then he goes on to say, like, he makes the claim that he fancied John Lennon. He makes the claim that he fancied John Lennon because he was a butch boy, I believe is the phrase he uses.
Yeah.
He says, this is, again, a phrase that he used, that Brian Epstein went out gay hunting.
Yeah.
And he makes claims about how he would, I think it's something along the lines of like him liking the challenge of trying to seduce heterosexual men. Yeah. Or in fact he uses the word boys, right?
Yeah.
So and he would get them drunk and try to seduce them. They would then react badly to this, beat him up, and that was something that he enjoyed because he was a masochist.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, there are obviously lots of stories and rumours about Brian Epstein and this part of his personal life. I personally don't feel like I know enough about... I don't feel like I know enough to be able to sift the truth from the sort of salacious gossip.
Yeah.
But I do feel like at this point the documentary has taken a weird tonal shift.
Yes.
Into sort of not just gossip, but also into a weird sort of verging on homophobic area.
Yeah.
Just because of the way that he has presented that piece of information as part of the documentary.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, that certainly could have... Well, it could have done with some editing, is a charitable way to put it. Yeah, the tone is kind of quite unpleasant. I think the things he's talking about, I'm not going to stray into this territory too much because I don't feel like I know enough of the facts about Brian's personal life. What I do remember from what I've read, I don't know about the thing of sort of pursuing straight boys. I do know that he got beaten up and mugged by people he thought were sexual partners. There seems to be a suggestion, I'm not saying it's 100% true, there seems to be a suggestion that he did enjoy the sort of danger, that, you know, that there was a sort of frisson with the danger. But, I mean, to be honest, even the fact that I've entertained this, I've sort of annoyed myself because it's relevant. Yeah. There isn't any reason for Hunter Davies to be going into it, much less us going into it, really.
And that's the point. I think that's it's more about the fact that the film decides to include not just that part of what they think is relevant to the story, but it's that they've allowed the, and I say it's the director, Alan G. Barker, right, has allowed that particular excerpt from that interview to be included within the film.
Yeah.
So let's move on to something more positive then. And by more positive, I mean something that's also negative, but we can criticise it and feel much more positive about ourselves in doing so.
Well, that's the main thing, isn't it?
Why else are we here? There are lizard throughout the documentary, and lizard is always a good it's always a good word to use when you know you're going to talk about something particularly bad. Lizard throughout the documentary, yep, are reconstructions,
yes,
of some of the songs that aren't really prevalent enough in the documentary for it to feel like it's consistent.
Yeah.
But also feel like they are removed enough to feel like there's been some kind of creative choice in making them happen.
Yeah. Yeah, they're reconstructions in the sense that they are kind of literal depictions of lyrics.
Hmm.
So there's a pretty nurse selling poppies from a tray. There's Eleanor Rigby, people putting flowers on her grave, I think. Hmm. And lovely Rita, the meter maid.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So all of the, you see these very fleetingly, because so a lot of the time, all a documentary needs, when its talking heads are telling you the information they need, you need to know, or they need something to put on the screen while that happens.
Yeah.
And depending on how much footage you've got, you know, you see a lot on sort of the cheaper true crime documentaries where somebody's talking and then they get a picture of the serial killer. And then they just very slowly focus in on their eyes, you know, just zoom in on their eyes. and that is just to take up the screen space while someone is talking.
Yeah.
In this instance, you can do a documentary of reconstructions. They were quite old hat for quite a while, and they're a bit more fashionable now. You see the Netflix documentaries use them a lot more. I think since about 20, I remember in about 2012 when documentaries like The Imposter, like Bart Layton, started making, yes, those films, and reconstructions in documentaries were very much sort of Channel 5 territory.
Yeah,
and,
true,
and
yeah,
he really brought them back, and they seemed to become a lot more popular. But you know, so it's perfectly fine to do a documentary with reconstructions in it, or sort of things illustrated by actors in some way. But you either do it or you don't. This has, I would say, a total of about a minute's footage in, yeah, the entire film.
I would argue like 25 seconds.
Yeah. And so I presume that you would have had to pay actors or something to do that, and you know, and people to film it and everything. When you could have just got a photo of, yep, of Ringo Starr and focused in on his eyes very slowly. But you know, you could,
that would be amazing. Can you imagine? Like, yeah, just, yeah, a, yeah, sinister tone that would just automatically adopt.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is, like, I don't even, I feel like there's a lot that is said, you know, in the interviews that then cuts to archival footage, which obviously makes sense. That's how documentaries work.
Mm-hmm.
The three examples you gave there, I don't feel like anything's needed at all.
No.
Like, I actually feel like, I was going to mention earlier that I believe it's Steve Turner who makes a very good point when he talks about why the Beatles decided to stop touring, which is he basically says that the songs that they wanted to write at the time and they were releasing at the time just weren't good for live gigs. You know, they were still touring after Revolver came out, but they were playing songs from before that album and before Rubber Soul even, because,
yep,
audiences wanted songs they could jump around to and dance to and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Which is a very good point. It's actually, I will say, isn't one that I hear often when I'm you know,
yeah,
reading up on or listening to Beatles stuff.
Yeah.
And he makes the point that, or he illustrates that point by talking about Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
Eleanor Rigby is the kind of song that Beatles had just released, but they couldn't play that live, not only because it's a moodier song and an audience won't dance to that, but also there was, I believe he makes the point that there is the idea that it has a bit of a somber element to it, because it talks about being in a churchyard, putting flowers on the grave, and etc. You don't need to then show someone in a churchyard putting flowers on a grave.
No.
I believe, like, the point stands on its own. Like,
I think you're right.
There's no need to cut, and I believe that's the case as well when they cut to discussion on Penny Lane, when they discuss very, very, very briefly, they talk about Lovely Rita.
Yep.
So it feels completely arbitrary. These sort of very short 5-second snippets of recreations.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense because I mean, it would make sense if you thought it was a reaction to, like, oh, I don't have footage here, I need to fill this in with something, because for all the other songs, you know, they've got something to put on the screen. Like I say, just a still photo or a bit of video footage of the Beatles getting out of a car and going into Abbey Road, of which there's loads and loads.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And you could repeat a bit from earlier on in the documentary. I mean, that happens a lot in the cheaper ones.
Right.
The really cheap ones.
Yeah, I know you mean. Yeah.
Recycled
archive footage that they're just using again.
Yeah. It's odd, and there's no reason to put it in, and, like, I don't know why. I appreciate I sound quite troubled by it. It's like, why is this happening? You know, but it is just the sort of thing I'll notice and then fixate on. It's just such a strange choice.
It's a creative choice. Like, work has gone into making that happen.
Yeah,
like, it's not just, you know, it would be different if they had a bunch of archive footage and they chose a weird clip to illustrate a point.
Yeah.
But they've gone out with a camera.
Yeah.
and hired actors, like you say, to do this.
Yeah, it's more work.
Yeah.
And cost to put this sort of, you know, as you say, 25 seconds worth of footage
for extremely little value.
Yeah.
Arguably no value. In fact, arguably negative value, because we are now on this podcast talking about how it undermines.
Point. To be fair, we're the only two people in the world who are bothered about it.
But, well, I don't know. I'll Google it later. I did have a big question for you.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, you are someone who has been consuming Beatles history for far, far longer than I have. And I wanted to get your sense of how much did this documentary present to you something you hadn't seen before or heard of before?
A bit is the answer. There was some stuff. Certainly there was some
footage. And I mean when it first came out as well, obviously, by the way. I'm coming from the position of... I've watched this now for this podcast, and I don't feel like there's a huge amount that I haven't seen before, but I don't know how much of that was because of the film and how much of it was already available before. Mm. So when you first saw it, when it first came out in 2017, there were some elements of it that you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, there was information in there that I didn't know before. So the Simon Napier-Bell bit, as I was talking about before, there was some footage that I hadn't seen before.
Mm.
It's not particularly significant footage. Certainly there's George hanging around with a load of guys with sitars. I just sort of realised that isn't something I'd seen before. It's not massively significant. I mean, the thing is, with any Beatles documentary, if it gives you anything you haven't seen before, then it's been worth the 2 hours, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the year before we'd had 8 days a week, the Ron Howard documentary, which we mentioned earlier, and that had certainly it was sort of slightly divisive in terms of its approach and certain stylistic choices, but it did have that story about them refusing to play to a segregated audience in Miami, I think it was, which was completely new on me, and absolutely is worth the price of entry. You know, just any new information or footage.
There's also, to be fair, there's also some archival footage here which I have seen before, but I never tire of seeing. Like, to be fair, most of that's true about any of the Beatles documentaries. I never think, oh God, I've seen this 100 times. Why are you showing me this? Like, it's always, like, as a fan, it's always fun to see. One of the things that I wanted to pick up on you was that, one of the many elements they talk about in the film is the LSD interview with Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
I love watching that interview because I always see that as a really good example of how Paul McCartney, even then at his very young age, was just really canny about media.
Yeah.
I feel like in a way that we've only really started to recognise widely recently. You know, it, when we talk about now, about, you know, since 2016, the idea of fake news and stuff, the idea that the media itself has a responsibility in terms of all its reporting.
Yeah.
In that context, rewatching that interview where Paul McCartney is talking about where he's being called out on admitting to taking LSD, and he is then in turn calling out the journalist and saying, "All right, you've asked me a question. I only want to be honest, and the responsibility is with you to decide whether or not to report that and spread that information."
Yep.
I thought that is unbelievably canny at that age and in that period of him to recognise that role that media plays.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I've seen that clip before, but watching it again the other day, I was really struck by that is an astonishing level of media literacy for someone of that age and in that era to have. Someone who has had this level of fame thrust upon him. But bear in mind, there would have been so much... The press was an industry that you just respected in that age.
Yeah.
And I think in the same way that politicians broadly were as well, like sort of journalists would sort of ask politicians questions and say, if it's not too impertinent a question to ask, would you mind telling us why,
I noticed that a lot. There's journalists on the doorstep and he's like, those wonderful moments where you just have members of the Beatles walking up some steps and the journalist is like, oh, hello, can I just have a word just for a moment? Everyone stops to speak.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and there was... I think people were just... it was a profession to respect and be revered and just be very, very polite about, you know. And Paul is basically there going, as you say, like, all I'm doing is telling the truth. And like to recognise that it's not just him, but it is a media organisation... That there is a wider sort of media landscape, industrial complex, if you like, he has these ideas in his head, in a way that I just don't think it is just astonishingly far-sighted for him to be thinking that way and so ahead of his time. I do think in terms of the way he dealt with and still deals with the media, he is a very, very canny operator. And I don't mean to suggest that there's anything sort of underhand or duplicitous about the way he acts, but he's very, very aware.
He's very aware of his own image, I think. He's very, he likes to have control of his own image.
Yes.
And I always think about that story about the journalist that turned up on his doorstep on the farm, and it gets often told around the recording of Ram sessions or even the first McCartney album.
Yeah.
Where he threw a bucket of water and then instantly knew what that would mean to chase after journalists and then sort of negotiate session. I feel like I think that he knows. You can't imagine John Lennon going to that effort, right? Like Paul McCartney was always very aware of having to control his public image.
Yes. Yeah, very true. I think that clip is really interesting for that. I think it's also... his body language I'm really struck by. He's in his own back garden at Cavendish Avenue.
Right.
Or at least I've always presumed that's the case. From when I've seen pictures of his back garden, it kind of looks like that. They're outside, it's summertime. So he presumably just invited this journalist in, we'll have a chat in the back garden. And he is completely in control of that interview. And there is a way he's sitting where he's sitting back in his chair and he's kind of swinging from side to side a little bit. And he's completely and utterly self-assured. And I think also, because from what I understand, I think maybe they say it in the documentary, actually, that the other Beatles, John and George in particular, were a bit like, well, LSD was our thing. We got there first. Why are you announcing it? Which is quite a funny schoolboy way of thinking about the whole thing.
The only
I liked it first. The only time
I've ever seen that interview has always been within the wider context of how John and George have been annoyed that he gave it.
Right. Because I think especially because he needed some convincing to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's even a story about he only did it once. In fact, George is particularly biting when he talks about that in the anthology. I seem to remember him being even more, just a little bit. He's definitely got a grudge that he still holds about that whole thing.
Yeah, but it's funny, isn't it? It's like, you know, the friend who was like, who held out on doing the thing that everyone else had got into, you know, and then he does it, and then he's all, like, he's in the newspapers. He was like,
yeah.
like Johnny LSD, like, this is my thing, you know. Like,
yeah.
Exactly. But that's quite Paul as well, actually. He has an awful lot of confidence and an awful lot of self-assurance. And I don't think it would occur to him to be like, actually, maybe there's a better spokesperson in the Beatles for this.
Yeah, no, not at all.
But I do think it's interesting that Paul, at the age of, I think, probably 25 then...
Oh, it's insane. It's crazy.
Yeah, is far-sighted enough to be thinking in this way. It's kind of nuts.
Really. In a way that I don't think, and this is probably doing the others a disservice, but I can't imagine the other Beatles being that, having the same position.
Yes.
Or being as far-sighted enough to be able to argue the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually. Maybe John. You can imagine John, particularly in later years, he seemed particularly insightful about how his image was created by and manipulated by media. I feel like he was very conscious of that.
Yeah.
But at that particular time, it felt like, it just feels like a very particularly modern argument to make, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, certainly John and Yoko, you know, sort of came up with the idea of, well, let's sell peace like, what do they call it? Like dishwasher. So it's not dishwasher, any dishwashers, but dish soap, right?
Yes.
And, you know, sell it like it's a product. And we're going to be in the papers anyway, whatever we do. So we might as well have a peace sign with us and advertise this thing like it's a product. So, yes, I mean, they kind of knew how to use the media. But I don't think John was kind of, would have thought about it in the same way Paul is in 1967.
Yeah. Where he's questioning the relationship and the actual dynamic of it.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Pete Best in his documentary, and I do feel like his inclusion here and the story that he tells in particular is particularly wonderful. And actually, I don't know. You were saying before about how, you know, if a film offers new insights or a new story, then it's well worth the 2 hours or however much money you need to pay to see it.
Yeah.
This is probably that moment for me because it's a really nice story that he tells. I don't know if it was known beforehand.
I don't think it was. Actually, I remember when I saw it the first time, talking to a journalist after the film screening, who was a guy who used to write for The Enemy, whose name I didn't get. And he said that the medals story that Pete tells was sort of new on him.
Hmm.
And I think he said something about, I think maybe it may even have been advertised as such in press releases. It may have said, and Pete Best is in it with a surprise new story or something like that.
Okay.
But certainly I didn't know that.
So the story is that it's his granddad's medals.
Yep.
Is it that actually are selected by Neil Aspinall, I believe, actually takes the medals in tribute to be used on the cover of the Sgt. Pepper album.
Yeah.
That John Lennon then uses as part of his outfit or his costume as part of that shoot.
Yeah.
And the way that Pete Best tells that, it's genuine emotion. You can tell that he's genuinely touched to know that his family has a legacy that extends onto what is the, you know, biggest selling or greatest, most popular album of all time.
Yeah.
It's really, really heartwarming when he tells that story.
Yeah. It's really nice that he has a connection with it as well.
Yeah.
Because I think probably when I first saw it, it had advertised that Pete Best was one of the talking heads. And I thought, what's he going to talk about with Sgt. Pepper?
Yeah.
And he is only in it telling that story.
For that, yeah.
And then one bit at the end, where he gets like the last word in it, which is also very nice. Because he is a guy who, you know, obviously he's not always been well served by the Beatles story. I always thought it was lovely when they released Anthology 1 and he finally got some money for everything.
Yes.
That was a really nice story. But there's affection in the way he tells that story. There's a connection to his mother as well, who would have been long gone by the time he told the story on the documentary. And you can see it kind of means something to him. And I wondered as well, as far as I'm aware, none of them had any contact with him other than bumping into him backstage at some gig in the early days.
And also, to be fair, the way he tells that story, they didn't even then at the time. It feels like it's Neil who is the go-between to make that story happen.
Not
that takes anything away from how nice it is, but it feels like that is, you know, that's he was the instigator to make that story happen for him.
Yeah, and I like also because they give him the last word, and because I forget how he expresses it, but he basically says, you know, like every country in the world knows this band and knows this album, and you know I'm just grateful that I could be a very small part of it. And I like the fact he's sort of given the opportunity to give his information, you know, sort of state his case at the end, and be acknowledged as a part of this story, which he is, and that he seems at ease with that. You know, he does. There's no bitterness in it. I mean, maybe there is bitterness in him, but he doesn't express any bitterness. So he doesn't seem to in public anymore, and he certainly doesn't in this documentary. I think they tied it up really nicely with him.
And then I guess, you know, on that note, it's good to put an end to our own small contribution to the success of Sgt. Pepper and the release of that album.
Yeah.
By bringing this episode to a close.
Yeah.
We appreciate you listening to our episodes. You can follow us on social media platforms using the handle @BeatlesFilmsPod. Please feel free to give us a follow there. Please feel free to give us a review for this episode as well, if you haven't already. That would be greatly appreciated. Otherwise, we will see you again next week for another episode about another film. Thanks again, and see you then.
See you then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.